Willem de Kooning, and at a certain point he says, content is a glimpse. It's very quick. It's, you know, and I thought, that's, I recognize how that works in poetry too. You know, sometimes you're just, you're flashing, you're glimpsing. Sometimes memories work that way, especially distant memories. At a certain point, I sort of declared to myself that I believed narrative, for me, in, while writing, was one word after the other.
Hi, welcome to the Ruth Stone House podcast. I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm talking today with the poet Anselm Berrigan. He's not only a poet, he's also a teacher and editor. I'm going to read his very fun, dark, sardonic bio. He's a poet, teacher, and editor of Offhand Accumulations. He is the author of various books, chapbooks, and other idiosyncratic publications, including Something for Everybody, Zero Star Hotel, They Beat Me Over the Head with a Sack, Free Cell, Notes from Irrelevance, Skacers with John Coletti, and Come In Alone. He is surviving in New York City and teaching where the work is available. Anselm, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Bianca. Thank you for having me.
Yay.
I'm really happy to be here.
Today we're talking about your book that just came out called Pregrets. Tell me a little bit about how Pregrets came to be. And I know it's a really good story.
Sure. The poems, I started writing them in 2014.
Okay.
And I went to see this show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, where I've lived most of my life. And it was a show by Jasper Johns called Regrets. And I'd always been interested in John's work, but and then I was especially interested in the fact that at the age of 80, he had a body of new work.
Mm.
And it was all based on a photograph he found that someone had taken of Lucian Freud, and he had a kind of ripped up version of it. And he took this image, and it seemed to me that he ran the image through every single kind of artistic process that he knew how to do. He printed it, he painted it, he doubled it, he did it black and white, he did it in color. And he really changed the way that it looked from and he changed scale, changed size. And but he also, there was also this kind of note that the show is called Regrets in part because the picture of Lucian Freud shows Freud sitting on a bed, kind of holding his hand up to his forehead as if in a certain kind of emotional pain.
Mm.
But then Johns also apparently has a stamp that says Regrets Jasper Johns that he uses whenever he wants to turn down some kind of invitation. So I thought, oh, that's funny. That's a funny play that opens up the word regrets. And so at the time I just put the word regrets up at the top of a page in a kind of 5x8 notebook I was keeping and wrote underneath it, and then realized I could do that multiply and get different kinds of language textures out of it. And then at some point the word pregrets popped into my head, and I started with that.
Mm-hmm.
And literally I'm just talking about putting that word or regrets. Then I sort of adapted degrets into it, and putting it at the top of the page and then writing underneath it from edge to edge of this relatively small page, and just kind of going phrase by phrase, clause by clause, only using commas for punctuation, and seeing what I could get. And initially the poems had a lot to do with memory, And then I started getting interested in thinking of them as sculptures, like literal sculptures, if I could figure out how to just kind of like stick a word or stick a phrase into the poem while keeping it continuous somehow, that would be this other way to work. And then I thought that the titles were open enough, like specific enough and open enough to be both funny and capable of having emotional range. And so I started, like, I would read from them sometimes at readings, and I'd say, well, regrets, we know what regrets are, or we should. Pregrets is like getting ready to have regrets. And then degrets are a total breakdown space. Mm. At least that's how I thought about it. It was like pregrets created a different kind of permission than regrets, which might actually be about examining specific experiences and memories. And then degrets could just be this kind of space that just went off the rails deliberately from the beginning, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And just hearing you talk about this makes me think how much like the feeling of regret is so unbearable when you're really in it. There was a quote I never forgot from Iris Murdoch's The Sea, the Sea, in which the main guy is like, regret almost as bad as jealousy. They're almost as unbearable as jealousy or something like that. And I was thinking, you know, like when you do really regret something, it feels, it does feel like you just want to get out of it so badly. But there's so much more that opens up when you start thinking about the word itself and about the experience of regret itself, that you're sort of forever traumatized by a regret. So you always are sort of in a state of pre-regret. Forever after, afraid you're going to do it again. And then sort of like, yeah, like I would, you know, and it does sound like a deconstruction of the experience of regret and pregrets. That's really interesting. That's really fun. And I like, you know, interesting, the Jasper Johns show, he was obsessing over this single image of another person, another artist, in what he perceived as a state of regret, and being sort of fascinated with another artist's perceived emotion that he's seeing, and then obsessing over it in his own work. What does that mean about his emotions? You know, one has to see the show to sort of get in there and think about it. But then this other layer of then you being a witness to this show, and then taking that out and creating this whole book in response to it, although not in response to it, that work. It's a really interesting exploration of ekphrastic poetry. There was John Yao who wrote that beautiful piece about your poems. He said, in pregrets, Berrigan collapses a diaristic space with a tonal one while rejecting the well-known model for ekphrastic poetry, which is the use of image and description to get inside the work. Talk to me a little bit about, in thinking about this book too, but like, how you see ekphrastic working in poetry. I mean, on the one hand, you have like the audience Musée de Beaux-Arts, you know, typical ekphrastic poem about a piece of work of art. And then you have a sort of like more even Ashburyan, like just balls out, like throwing yourself into somebody else's stuff. Is that something you do often in your work? Or, I mean, I see a beautiful piece of art behind you right now. Art's important to you.
This is a painting by my friend, Zach Wallard, who's a terrific painter who lives in Brooklyn, who I've known for a long time. Yeah. I mean,
I just like blabbed for like 15 minutes and now I'm like, okay, answer that.
That was great. And there's a number of different ways that I can respond to everything you've said, because there are also these different overlapping kind of circles inside of how this book got made. John Yao is the publisher of Black Square Editions, which put out Pregrets, right? And he wrote that review based on a chapbook, which now is the first section of this book. So he got interested in the initial set of poems that I wrote about it on his own. And then when I had this manuscript together, you know, several years later, he was interested in reading it. So there's a way that was kind of creating a full circle situation. When I started writing the regrets and pregrets poems, I had this chance to get to go down to Captiva Island in Florida, where Robert Rauschenberg has had his studio for a long time in the last sort of third or so of his life. And that studio, an area, has been converted into a residency for artists, and they had a pilot program for artists with kids. And somebody nominated Karen Weiser, my wife, and I to be able to go down and have basically childcare for a month and work. And they gave us studios. I was sitting in this garage. They wanted to give me this kind of pristine space, and I said, "Well, wait a minute. Can I sit in that garage and work there?" And so then the poems, out of respect for Rauschenberg, who was, you know, very close with John's, and then not, in another way, like a complicated personal relationship, but kind of always in touch. Out of respect for Rauschenberg, because his library was available, I started looking more closely at his work, and specifically his combines that he was making in the 50s and into the early 60s, and started to better understand that he was combining painting and sculpture in his mind and finding things, detritus, odd objects, and then kind of gluing them together into these works. And I thought, I can work parallel to that. I can try to do my version of what that would be, but in language, with language as the material. So then I was in this funny space of being kind of informed / inspired by Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, these two very well known, but then also kind of pre-Stonewall queer artists who wore ties all the time in the 1950s. And who were sort of making work in the kind of wake of abstract expressionism, and being really interested in that work, but wanting to do something different. And I was also in this kind of intense period of reading a lot about painting in general, and being really interested in the way that painters, but also sculptors, dancers, filmmakers, and other artists, but particularly visual artists, talked about their work, like what it was like for them, or what it's like for them to be alone having to make decisions. And I was finding that there were certain ways in which I could translate some of certain folks' ideas or discussions about materials into a language version of that would allow me then to try to, I was trying to change the way that I related to language in my poems. And so these poems really kind of built out of that. And so then there is a lot of reference back to individual works and things that I'm looking at. But also, now I'm going on and on, John Yao wrote this catalog essay for a show of Robert Creeley's collaborations with artists.
Cool.
And I got a hold of the the catalog one day at, I think, Mercer Street Books here in New York, over by Broadway and Houston, or Mercer and Houston. And one of the things that John was getting at was that Creeley was interested in using the artwork as the source of the writing. So it's as if he was writing out of the artwork rather than writing back into it. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So that's a way to think about ekphrasis differently. So that you're not just doing description. And I think description is important, and it's super interesting. And there's a lot of poems that go inside of works of art that I love. But I was interested in this idea of how I could make that work, because it both made complete sense, but then also was like, okay, well, how do you do that? How do you come out of somebody else's work? Like, you're not in it, but maybe you can put yourself in it and imagine your way out of it. You know, there's this short piece written by the painter Amy Silman, who I've worked with in the past, and in a teaching context. And she talks about leaving her studio one day, looking up at the sky, seeing a certain shade of pink with pigeons flying across it who are being flown by somebody on a roof, and realizing, that's how I can finish my painting. Like, there was something in a painting that she couldn't resolve, and she went out and she looked up and saw something, and went down and figured it out. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's like, well, and I just thought, well, that's a little bit like hearing a phrase or seeing a sign, seeing a piece of language, and realizing, oh, I can stick that somewhere. I can solve a problem in a poem. I can make a little bridge. Like I related to the idea that an instant glimpse could then be the key to finishing a shape, right? Yep. But at the same time, or there's this piece called Content is a Glimpse, which is an interview with Willem de Kooning, but with all of the questions taken away. So it's like this running monologue.
Yeah.
And at a certain point he says, content is a glimpse. It's very quick. It's, and I thought, I recognize how that works in poetry too. You can, sometimes you're flashing, you're glimpsing. Sometimes memories work that way, especially distant memories, when you're so far away from an experience that you only have pieces of sensation. And so then that got me into kind of just looking around for things that people write, and also reading interviews with painters. And I found that Adrian Piper wrote really interestingly about artwork, but from this total other kind of philosophical space. And Stanley Whitney, a painter whose work I really love, talks about stacking color in an interview. And somehow then that gives me an idea of thinking about what stacking in a poem might be like. But I have to make some kind of transference or translation of what that means, because my materials, or our materials, are quite different than paint. But the articulation of impulse and having to make decisions, and making decisions fast or making them slow, is where I think there's a huge amount of overlap across the arts. And it's one of the things that allows our artists to keep talking to each other, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it's 100% about a conversation between people across time, across genres, and keeping it going endlessly. There's no answer. It's interesting because everyone's sort of trying to figure something out that's not figure outable. And all the while, as they pick up on what other artists have done, and when they experience their art, right, they're witnessing the art, but really what's happening is something's happening in them that, like you're saying, like the content itself, sometimes we forget, is sort of mere compared to all the fallout from it, the way it can affect you, all the context that it's presented in. And then you have a reaction to it and make something else. I think it's really incredible, because it's incredible what you're doing, everything you're saying for the poetry world. And it's important because, you know, going from a poetry bubble where people are really locked into what they think they understand about poetry and how poetry is written and how limiting that is, just in their own experience as artists, but also how it sort of doesn't make for good poetry. You're the kind of person that's constantly searching for these little bridges between ideas and to like make things happen. It's really, really refreshing to hear. It makes me want to ask you, though, I couldn't help but come up against this, but like your ideas about narrative. I think someone like Jasper Johns or like certain kinds of painters, like the way that narrative works in visual art and sculpture, in collage, it's like, obviously it's very, very different than the written word. Moreover, poetry is very different in how it deals with narrative than prose. And yet people get very confused about the use of narrative in poetry. And that somebody commented on a Twitter post I made. I just wanted to read it because it links to this. I said something about how I just wanted good poetry, how I wanted other people to want poetry. And somebody said, they just comment, love poems that are comprehensible, not trying to be obscure, visceral yet illusory and slippery. I think we can infer what they're implying is that's the kind of poetry they like. And I felt my defenses rise a little bit at this idea of people trying to be obscure. And I felt like, how can we know they're trying to be obscure? Like, and if they are trying to be obscure, what does obscurity mean in a poem and with in terms of narrative as well? So just any of your thoughts on that?
Sure. It's an ongoing question. I seem to be finding myself in different phases of relation to it every few years. You know, and some of that comes also with talking about work with students who are 18, 19, 20, 21, or even a little older, sort of trying to figure out, you know, what to do about questions of obscurity, readability, relatability, these kinds of things. And on the one hand, I sort of believe you have to kind of break free of those questions and kind of just move forward and make the work that you make based on your relationship with language. But you have to start to understand your relationship with language and then figure out how you can change it as needed. And I think when I started writing poems, or at some point in the first 4 or 5 years of writing poems, I felt, and I started a little, I don't know if it late is the word, but I didn't really start writing poems till I was 19, even though my parents were poets. It never occurred to me that was something I was gonna do. But I was sort of in school training to be a journalist. And I got really excited about the possibilities that came with breaking a line once I actually did it. Mm-hmm. And I realized that though I had been trying to write stories a little bit, I was more interested in words and how they could go next to each other and become sequences in different ways than I was in plot and character in a sense. And then that extended out later to kind of realizing one night when I was 25, 26, that I had this problem. And the problem was that I had been trained in my education to write compositionally. And then when I sat down to write, I always wanted to start with I as a subject and then put a verb next to it. And that I actually, that there was something really limited about that. And I was jumping through all these hoops using scissors and glue, using computers once I was able to actually afford a computer, and doing different things to kind of cut up and rearrange the work and change and find a way towards unconventional syntax, because I wrote about music a lot in college. I wanted my poems to relate to sampling and relate to distortion and relate like guitar distortion and to parallel some of that action, because I knew music better than I knew poetry at that point. And so I went through this process of kind of I think what I was trying to do, I wouldn't have put it this way, was to try to de-skill myself in terms of composition, like writing compositionally in terms of making essays with beginnings and middles and endings, and to get to a place where the language that I was collaging together, because it was more powerful or richer, more interesting to me, was something that I could generate without outside methods.
Right.
And for about a year, I worked on that. And it worked. It worked so well that I actually then had trouble writing sentences, like regular sentences, for a while, which was a problem because I was writing short reviews anonymously for Publishers Weekly to make a little money. And I was like, I can't even do this anymore. No.
I love it. That's so great. I mean, so much of the problems that I see happening in new writers' work is, you could see it from a mile away, the essayistic way of writing that we learn in school first, you know, like that we first learn how to write and do, you know, so much of the work of working with students is like dismantling their, you know, habits of like thinking that that's how you have to write, and that to make it a poem it's just about, you know, making it pretty.
I meant to say this before. At a certain point, I sort of declared to myself that I believed narrative, for me, in while writing, was one word after the other, and it didn't matter what the words were. And I think by doing that, I was trying to give myself the permission to foreground sequencing and worry less about making everything connect in a kind of traditional compositional way. And it's like, well, what if everything is out of order? It still has to flow. Like, it still has to sound good.
Right.
You know,
and there's like a sonic rhythm to the world that appeals to the ear that we have to adhere to.
Yeah. My dad has had this story about Jim Carroll, you know, and Jim Carroll was this sort of all city basketball player in high school in the 60s, before he started really getting hooked on heroin and also writing poems. Like he was by the accounts I've heard, a potential NBA level player and athlete, you know, and one of the things that, and he met my father when my father was in his, I don't know, early 30s, and Jim was a teenager, and they became fast friends. But at some point, Jim said to him, well, you know, the thing about playing basketball that I learned playing on the playgrounds in New York City is that it's good to know how to do everything and be fundamental, but it's also important to really look terrific while you're doing it. Right.
Absolutely.
And I'm not trying to kind of like transplant that onto the poems, but when I'm like working on these poems in particular, I'm like, all right, I'm doing this stuff. I don't know if it's going to really end up making sense to anybody other than me, but if I can just make it sound good, in certain ways, that'll guide me. through the space of the poem, not to be superficial, but to make sure that there's some kind of buzz that's continuing so that the logic of the poem is perceivable.
Right.
If you hear it.
You know? Right. Right. I mean, when you think about how we interact with art, it's like, there's an aesthetic pleasure that we get out of looking at it, even if we don't understand what we're looking at. Right. So we're like, artists are going to like be excruciatingly, be excruciating to figure out the right colors in the right places and the right textures and all these things. Beauty is involved. Beauty is deeply involved. But also in your poetry, reading it is a sonically pleasing experience, even if one doesn't know what's happening.
Thank you.
All the time. Yeah, it's like the delight that you have in word choice is obvious to me. And I therefore am delighted reading a line. And I don't question, I stop, it's hard not to question, what's happening. But I stop questioning because of the rhythm and the visual pleasure of the words, because I can see that that's as much involved as the sound. And I can see your choices that you're making in these poems too. It's not always the same. You're constantly, you're like I said before, and what I can hear from here, what you're saying, like you're always searching for these things. And you don't seem content to settle on one. So there's like a real playfulness. At the same time, what I see too coming through is an absolute, like very personal exploration of identity, towards yourself and your family and your city and these other artists and, your life. Like I think we should definitely read one now. I think it's a good time. Do you want
to? Yeah.
I made some suggestions, but really anything you read would be lovely.
No, I liked those suggestions that you made. And I think I'll start with the poem Regrets that's on page 35, because I think that's one out of the four you suggested that resonates with particularly with some of the things that we've been talking about, because I do actually want the surfaces of the poems to change from time to time. Like sometimes, mm-hmm. This question of differentiating across a series of works that are all taking approximately the same form or a similar form. Like I was conscious of that in putting the manuscript together. Like, how do I make this be same and different at the same time so that people don't feel like they're having right. that same, but like consistent, but also different, so that the experience of each poem is different.
I was very grateful for that aspect of it.
Okay, so this is Regrets. This is actually the first poem in the second section of the book, which is in four sections, for the record. Regrets. I told the apparently latent little box I was slapping myself recursively. Long live the down with, the box frame, the howdy human condition. But I was relaying re to pre to avoid having to add minute. But I was lying. Like now I'm just trying to remind your yous I can do this, being a thingless telefat on the hill, so as to speak as, give my love to the air out there, the sets of smactivated paces. I was ordered to kill a spider yesterday, more pesticides for me and my roots. I should look up the origin of out of the blue idiom, but you can decoratively do it for me with a sagacious hose in the alley, an alley priming its pump in another world. Alas, sitting here in cold anonymity, someone who doesn't dig me, platonically, walks in werewolf-specific shirt rips. That wall is being red flashlights, called upon by irradiated day-glow yellow fold to sit watching the game on radio. Don't you ever draw on a napkin with my pen again, you little winner. In the 70s, the adults could raise money during the day and still hate dinner. Now we're supposed to be complex, never broke, and critically violent while dissolving the masks of subjectivity. Well, we are. You don't have to care about that shit. Okay, so then this is an earlier one. And in my mind, this poem is dedicated to the poet Douglas Kearney. Regrets. All you're going to be doing is serving mass movement. All you're doing in the service of prior mass movements. All you're doing, server, irreversible alls, moving all your inward logic torn out to move. All your wobbly pieces being alls, moving off decisions to move bodies. All pre's are covers to cover irreversible unknowns. All pre's are broken frames humanly stuck behind some claims to know time by Marx. I don't know in my fantasy all fantasies of non-intelligence. Constantly jabbed, that pelican's an old form flying by this fish house. Any pre might be a plunge breaking down to be anybody's pieces next to and next to next of and nests to that ibis sitting there, a weird old form pumping its bee next to that arc of a beak. My dig down interruption interrupted by a cormorant head popping up. All my alls are 2D pre's pitched at arcs to undo as if free. And then I could read two more, the other two you mentioned.
Yes.
Okay. That's funny. Oh, okay. I didn't understand the transparency of the post-it that I have on the page. This is Degrets. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't understand the transparency of the post-it that was on this poem.
Well, I couldn't tell if it was on one side or the other side of the page.
Ah, I see. That's that kind of transparency.
Yeah, and my vision is starting to go. So that's a minor 49-year-old's remark.
That's okay. A 49-year-old's remark.
Degrets. How much time wasted waiting to be loved, unable to identify any love coming. There's the end. It can't even pretend to stop. Words collapse into your movement, a gym of gestures you pay to sweat within in honor of something like extension. Lines enter our ears. Lines swim before our faces. We enable brutality against our wishes, which are barely known to us. And that's a lie. We're too many to know. And why isn't a flower a star if nothing else is available? You can have your wise translations. You have them already. Your whole sense of truth is fed laterally. Pity the applied ending. It's only a desperate face commanding us to begin again. If the hook wasn't sound, I'd raise you off it. Cleanse the little tear with a list or erstwhile fabricated substitute, like the sweet powdered hard core from the blooming old shit store. I was wrong to say lie up there, but it's okay. We're not going to rule out a long-term extension as long as pure daylight stays out of the way.
God, that's so beautiful.
That was on the no pile for a long time.
Oh God. I'm glad it. It's funny how that happens. It's a yes poem. It's a yes poem.
No, thank you.
Well, I think this poem too is sort of has like a little more vulnerability or something in it. Like, I like that there's little poems that are like they go off track a little bit. But I was also thinking, I don't know, maybe I'm just making too much out of it, but it seems like lies come up a lot in the book. There's this, I mean, I guess it kind of connects with the idea of regret. Moral questioning, you know, like sort of what is everything regret or is everything just it is what it is, you know, like there's, you know, I say things that are fucking lies, you know, like, but they're also the truth, you know, it's a dissatisfaction with our sort of dualistic system, or our dualistic moral system seems to be in question.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I was writing these poems. I started writing these poems as I think I said at the outset in 2014, and I wrote them across 2015 and 2016, and I kind of decided that I'd exhausted it in 2017. So, you know, I'm writing them in the last couple years of the Obama presidency, and then the first year plus of the Trump presidency. And that poem in part was, I think, came out of, you know, dealing with the extreme negative feelings and concern that I had about Donald Trump being elected president, and just that could happen, where it was going to go, and that kind of thing, and also trying to understand, you know, being not trying to understand, but trying to recognize in the work some sense of an acceptance of cultural meanness, which, you know, kind of flashes up to the surface of the poem. And I think the book is roughly in chronological order. It's in these four sections, and the sections were like within the section, each section, the poems are not necessarily in chronological order in terms of when I wrote them. But I wrote the first group first. And that's when I was kind of getting going and figuring out what I thought I could do within this frame of pregrets and regrets and degrets and then the other variations that pop up. And then the middle two sections are heavily involved with thinking about artwork and experiencing it, and then also just letting, you know, trying to have a handle on an internal world and the external world at the same time. In the poems. And then the last section, things I think maybe do get more vulnerable, possibly in some ways, because that those middle two sections got explored, and in those in the last section I was still trying to figure out what I could do with the form, but then like I think that's the section where things really change from poem to poem the most, maybe, if I understand my own work. And that's where some other things come in. Like there's one poem that takes place almost entirely at a playground and kind of rhymes all the way through, you know, and is based on my trying to understand what I think realism is. because I had read this essay by the painter Rackstraw Downs called What Realism Means to Me, and I was really super interested and moved by his writing. He's a very good writer, and he's a great painter, you know, and so I sort of started that one poem by trying I didn't read that poem, but I started this poem by kind of borrowing a phrase that he used in the essay, and then trying to kind of be on the ground in the playground. And then I just found myself rhyming on one rhyme, like an E rhyme all the way through the poem. I was like, what are you doing? You know? but I love rhyme, and I wanted to kind of see it through.
Right.
You know, and I don't know, I'm kind of babbling.
I love that point when you're like, what the fuck am I doing? You're like, whatever, I'm just going to follow the poem.
Well, I think that there's like this, I sometimes feel this competing impulse, and I wonder if you feel this or other poets feel this, but there's this competing impulse that isn't always competing. Sometimes it's overlapping, you know, between being completely independent as an artist and as a person. And then also recognizing the need to speak to larger situations that are taking place in the community, in the country, in the city, in the world. Like that sort of idea of the role of the poet, something traumatic happens. Is it, you know, what is the responsibility? And I think I've always wanted to try to create a space where that responsibility, no matter how nonsensical, abstract, pejorative words describing things that don't make sense, no matter how like far out my work might go in that direction, that there's always room for that responsibility to be available too.
The responsibility and
to speak from the condition and to speak from and to and with the conditions of widespread coexistence.
Like the conundrum of the second industrial revolution in psychoanalysis that I'm reading about right now. I mean, it's like, I mean, it 100%. You know, you want to play with language and reality and the internal world, the internal landscape, and hope that exploration offers other people something. And then it's like, well, what about the larger, what about society? What about the world? What about, you know? I mean, I guess it is kind of like, there can only be somewhat of an interest in both, because both are reality. We have our internal explorations that speak to a human condition or a human consciousness that is forever interesting, and basically one of the biggest reasons we're here, we should explore that. But yeah, then always leaving some sort of space for the larger picture, I guess.
I think also maybe it's just sort of figuring out when specific conditions conditions of reality as one perceives it have to invade the space of the poem, and maybe invade is not quite the right word there, but like I found writing last year during the pandemic, the pandemic's still ongoing, but during the onset of it and across the summer, to be something I had to try to do. I couldn't type anything up. I could write into a notebook, but I couldn't type anything up. And there was no way for me to write and not have that. I found myself kind of like returning to certain kinds of very plain gestures and actions that I've relied upon in writing for years, because I just wanted to be able to function as a writer, and I mean as a poet, and to produce some language and to record my consciousness as I could, you know, map. You know, the experience of being thrown into this pandemic, saturated language, there was no way to avoid it. You could not refer to it necessarily, but for me it was an evident aspect of reality that if I was going to sit down and write, it was going to have to come in. But how to let it come in, what decisions to make about vocabulary, about my own sort of mental state within it, and then dealing with this kind of like crushing amount of language coming in from media, from politicians, from everybody talking about it, you know, it was very difficult to figure out how to have a filter, what kind of filter to figure out how to have. It was also part of the challenge of writing anything at all. And sometimes I felt so bent that, you know, I just write stuff down and on one side of the page, and then I'd move to the other side of the page. I was working in a big notebook, and I would write other things that would comment on the inadequacy of what was just said on the other side of the page. You know, it is a poem. And so I have these like poems that I have no idea if they're any good or not, but they're like multiple voices in the poem kind of teasing and quarreling with each other because none of them are clear as to any kind of certainty, which almost makes them just interesting.
Right, on a ground level,
but it's going to take me a while to figure that out.
It's interesting because it's definitely the state you were in, right? So you're sort of like incredibly authentic and aware of the mental state you were in and reflecting that in poetry, through your poetry, and not trying to fit what state you were in into the box of the pre-established poetry recipe, right? So like, a good lesson for our listeners in terms of like being like super open to how language is unfolding in your mind and not trying to fit it into the way that we think language is supposed to unfold creatively.
Yeah.
It's funny when we think about like obscurity and reality in poetry, when reality and obscurity work so different. Like what we think is, the way the mind works, I guess is what I'm saying, is non-linear and doesn't adhere to information giving as we know it in most language-based writing and opportunities and conversation.
This is making me think a little bit about Philip Whalen's poetry and that in certain poems of his, every now and then he would just say, "I'm really hungry and I have no money." Right, and it's just this sort of immediate. I want to eat, I don't have any money, and it gets weaved into the fabric of the poem because then something else gets said, right? But it's this like present declaration of a bodily physical reality, and then when he's doing it, he has a way of making it also somehow sound funny is not the right word, but it's humorous the way that it appears. It's timed to be, you know, no more or less than what it is. And then at the same time, one of the books that's been the most important to me over the last 10 to 15 years is this book, B. Jenkins by Fred Moten. And in part because there's this interview in the back of the book where he talks about how some of the poems got written. And the interviewer very sensitively listens to his description of how a certain poem that happens to be called Johnny Cash, but then has a title that comes in at the ending, which is Rosetta Tharpe. Like all of the poems in B. Jenkins are the titles, they're all names of people important to Fred Moten. And then sometimes the titles, they're like these brackets and there's a second name that you get at the end of the poem. And by reading the poems, you don't learn all that much necessarily about the person who's being named. They're really, in a certain way, without trying to reduce it, they're portraits of Fred's experience with the work or mind or person of that he's naming. And it's icons, it's heroes, it's musicians, it's colleagues, it's also family members. And it's a really beautiful book. But it's a funny book, I think, for people to read sometimes, because as he breaks it down, his thinking about Johnny Cash has a lot to do with growing up in his mother's house and listening to music and then doing his own research into Johnny Cash's life and Rosetta Tharpe's life. And they're both from Arkansas and he's from Arkansas. And what he's kind of saying in the interview is that he's moving from He's moving across his consciousness in relation to his experience of this person's person, you know, as expressed through their work or through how he knows them, if he knows them. And then the interviewer asks him, and this is the sort of sensitive question, he says, well, you know, it's, you should not reveal the sources and background of all of this material, but if we don't know this, maybe we're not getting a full experience of the work. Mm-hmm. And I respectfully sort of disagree about the notion of the full experience, because I think if you read any poem, you have a full experience of it. If you find something else out about it, about its background later, then you have another experience of it. Right. If you reread it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so like a full experience, I think, is not about being informed about everything that's in the poem. It's about just sort of listening all the way through it and then figuring out what that experience was. And, you know, and then Fred goes on to talk. I'm saying Fred, I know him a little bit, and you know, he goes on to say that he had this conversation with his mom, who, when he put out his first chapbook of poems and he sent it to her, and she sort of said, I was taught poetry in class in school and I didn't like it. I didn't like being taught poetry.
Right.
But I know from that when I'm reading your poems, that your poems are not like that at all. So right. What is it that you're doing?
Right.
And then he relates this conversation that they had, and that it was painful for him to hear his mom not be able to kind of recognize their house and in his poems, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, he was saying, I need to work on the outskirts of sense. Because I think it's a richer area out there. Mm-hmm. And I think he's also talking about a certain kind of protection. Like you got to be able to, like, you can be too known by people who are trying to assume they know you, you know? And then yeah. I think that gets into other questions about identity and Blackness and just like the eyes that get put on the people.
Right.
And the assumptions that get made. So like, I'm interested in the outskirts of sense too. But I think I'm interested in it from this angle of feeling like I could never assert myself in my life until I started writing. And I need to assert the ability to say things in different ways. And I also need to assert the ability to put words in orders that might seem obscure or nonsensical to others, but that are actually quite logical to me in the way that I'm thinking about how a poem might get made. And then that extends out to how, you know, music and art and all other walks of life might function. Now babbling a little bit, you know.
Well, you're allowed to babble on a podcast where you're being interviewed.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it's really beautiful to think about wanting to assert yourself in your own poetry and allowing yourself, honoring how your mind works, how you feel makes the most sense, and expressing what language does in your mind and how you interact with objects in the world and your experiences and your thoughts and ideas about present things and future things and past things. There's something I find just wonderful about this freedom of, really is just a freedom of expression, right? But you're also thinking about an audience. You're thinking about wanting people to read your work. You know, to some extent, I mean, you can also think about what kind of audience, you know, you're not trying to like speak to every single person in the world. That's always kind of like that's a bad place to be in, to want to do that. I feel like that's just hell.
I feel like in that spot, you know, it's more about the possibility of anybody connecting to the work than everybody. Right. And then, you know, who I feel responsible to in terms of the presentation of the work. I mean, I think that kind of thing really changes from person to person, but yeah, Harriet Mullen in her poem Muse and Drudge, which I first experienced live in the mid 90s in San Francisco, is one of the most important poems for me. And it's this 80-page long poem. And that poem, along with a poem by a poet named Kevin Davies called Carnal Bunt, I think those two poems in the mid to late 90s had this tremendous impact on me in different ways. And I, in an interview, I believe Mullen says, I think anybody might be able to find something in the poem to recognize, to connect with. But she's not assuming that everybody's going to get every reference or recognize every word, you know, and she's somebody with a completely expansive vocabulary who just loves words, right? She wrote a book called Sleeping with a Dictionary.
Right.
And I felt like that created possibility for me in a certain way. Like I could think about anybody more than I could think about everybody. Cause yeah, the problem with that, that's the one of the problems with the notion of universality, if it's presented in a certain facile way, is that it shuts down specificity, it shuts down particularity, it shuts down idiosyncrasy, it shuts down detail, because you feel like you have to say something that everybody can recognize, and like that's insane.
Yeah, and it's not what it's about, right?
Right.
Well, I'd love to hear one more poem.
Okay.
To sing us out. And
I'll read this poem that that you suggested, that's called Megrets.
Of Megrets. Let me pull it up. Which page is it on?
It's on page 82. And I have to say, maybe I should just say beforehand that I sort of refer to poet as if poet is a character in the poem. And it comes out of reading books by the novelist David Markson, I think around the time that I was reading this. And David Markson's last, I don't know, three or four books were like these extended lists of sentences that I think he was writing on flashcards that were index cards. And they were sort of facts about specific people, mostly artists across time. And he was really kind of breaking down what the novel could be for him. And then every now and then he'd refer to himself or the speaker as author, you know. So then like there's like one of the books, it's called Vanishing Point, maybe, or there's like one of these books is called This Is Not a Novel. Another book is called Vanishing Point. And there's like a long passage in one of them where it's just all about all the ways that all these different artists died. And it's just like a sentence and a space and a sentence and a space. It's kind of like Mamet Bursenbrugge's double spaced form in a way, and Louis Wurst does this other variation of it. And then every now and then he'd say author can't get out of bed or something like that.
So, love that. It makes me like, like moments like that. I'm like, oh, there's a fiction writer I can get down with.
Yeah, no, they're and they read really fast. You know, it's like you're reading them and you feel like you're cheating almost. But then when you get through the end, it's this like kind of profound accumulation of somebody else's information. And what do you do with all of that fact and memory, which seems to be part of what he was trying to deal with too, I think.
That's so cool.
Anyway, Megrets, and I'll dedicate it to the memory of David Markson. Poet identifies with negative space hidden by the index card, held together by dripping thread and the all-over action pigeons control. Poet is not assuming anyone knows what shame is, slapping photographs of fossilized catastrophe, sun-baked onto station ways, trains go by. Poet's stain hums its declining balance in an illusion of equilibrium. In New York, poet can rent this podium for $500,000 per week. Poet will leave the difficulty to the panelese, attendees, and dig-resistant philosophies. Poet don't dig doubts on salaried vibrations or certainties baffled strokes. It's all shit to spread on the airways when the money gets waved. Bacterial ghostlings installing little doorlings. Poet keeps peeling dispersed compositions off poet's body brace. Still likes being talked to by the air and talking back, walking against the psychoelectronic traffic. Will never stop swearing and swearing off. Figures the music makes it linear. Senses the deliberate inability to not quite remembers the skill of the ineffable fuckface. Won't pat back at expense of pigeon siblings' backs.
God damn. God damn, that's good. Oh, damn. I love that poem.
Thank you. I think I still don't understand what the hell I was thinking in that last line, but that's okay.
I think you just went all out in that last line. Won't pat back at expense of pigeon siblings' backs.
Pigeons are pigeons in New York City are my spirit animal. I've come to the conclusion.
Anselm, thank you so much for talking with me about your incredible new book. I'm so excited about everything you're doing and thinking about. And I mean, there's always so much more to get into, but I hope we can talk again in the future. And
thank you for having me. And I think it's really great that you're doing a poetry podcast. I mostly listen to podcasts about basketball.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Ruth Stonehouse podcast.